Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
2.5 men almost equals 2.5 million.
Will 9 and 10's ad share really be decimated?
Australia's most loved TV show.
Telstra transformed in Technicolor.
Ownership shakeups at Australia's ad agencies.
Revealing the name behind the comment. The ongoing issue of online anonymity. With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is boss of Fusion Strategy, Steve Allen.
Good morning, how are you?
And podcast producer, Alice Terlikofsky.
Hi, everyone.
Now, Steve, welcome along. I think this is your first appearance on the podcast. Maybe just start by explaining what Fusion Strategy does for those who don't know.
Well, we're just a strategy and analyst agency. We sell strategies to clients or the media themselves. We do analysis and forward planning for clients and for the media themselves. And we pump out a whole lot of stuff every day of our life.
And one of the things that you do, which I think journalists find very useful, is offering your kind of wider analysis on how the networks are doing. Now, the one of the points that we alluded to in the headlines at the top was this question of what share is going to do for 9 and for 10, advertising share next year. This week we've seen 7 have their programming launch for next year, 10 have already done theirs. Your instinct is that there are some potential risks for 9 and for 10 if they don't get their act together in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. They're going forward at minus 20s in peak night. They're going forward for 9 even on a group basis, including their digital channels, at minus in the key 16 to 54 buyer demographic. So they're facing negotiations at the moment with their main channel well and truly underwater and their overall position not equaling last year. So they have got all the gains that they made in negotiation last year are likely to be taken away if buyers are practical and follow the figures and look at the inventory upcoming. We're yet to see 9s, as you know, but that will be a key. What inventory have they actually got, and do we trust that they will put it to air, and do we trust that it will rate?
I suppose one of the feelings to me is they had an absolutely dreadful first half of the year, and maybe things improved a bit. They had a hit with the block, Underbelly came back. You know, are 9 starting to claw back a little bit, do you think?
They are starting to claw back a little bit. At one point, I think they were minus 24 on the main channel in 16 to 54.
This is down 24% on last year.
And they're now minus 18 or something. So they are clawing back a bit of ground. But, I mean, that was kind of the low point. But, you know, when we're talking to overseas analysts and commentators and other people that want to drop in, you know, they're not going to make up the ground that they've lost this year. So they're going to face negotiations no matter what, well and truly underwater, and it's only if they've got a 6 or 8 week period that's respectable.
So I suppose, I think it already looks like we're going to see Celebrity Apprentice rush into the schedule by the looks of it. I think that might be a hit. What do you reckon?
Minor hit, at best. You know, we've been maybe too tough on them. They certainly think we've been way too tough on them. In calling every program announcement that they've made. They made a program announcement in May to a group of people in club about what was happening and where they were and how they were going to make up ground. And we said, look, you already say that 3 hits will make a network. We don't think the 3 hits in the product that you've given us. We think there might be a couple of minor hits, and they have been. So far our call's been reasonably accurate.
And I suppose that's the argument, is that we've seen 10 and 9 recently being, you know, one-show networks. We saw 10 leaning everything on MasterChef, and then when the renovators didn't work, then things went wrong. We've seen 9 similarly with The Block. While The Block was on, they did very, very well. But you say three shows are what it takes to drive through.
That's Gingell's analysis, and I guess his management group, that's what they believe is all you need. You just need 3 hit shows, and it will lift the overall station perception, the overall station ratings. We don't quite buy off completely on that, but we do agree that if you have shows, particularly if there's a strip show amongst them or a multi-day show amongst them, it does have a halo effect, let's say.
And how much does luck come into it? For instance, I guess one of the turning points for 7 and also for the ABC network in the US was when that network had hits with Desperate Housewives and with Lost in the same season, which then did very well here in Australia as well. And that was a big moment, but you couldn't have called it because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a studio that up to that point had been putting out loads of great content. So in the end, is it just luck?
No, it's not just luck. And last night's Channel 7 2012 up front, really subtly, not aggressively as you could have expected, really said it isn't. It's consistency, persistence, planning and looking to the future. Now, when those shows that you just mentioned came to Seven and came on air, they programmed them and promoted them brilliantly, but they were already on the rise. I mean, 2004, Leckie got there and he already had started to build new programs quite quickly, remarkably quickly. In fact, 6 months after he arrived, he had half a dozen shows he was putting to air. Now, they may have been in development before he got there, but he certainly gave the go button. So, yes, suddenly they had sexier, better demographic shows going with a whole bunch of reality that he'd always already commissioned. But no, we don't buy that you can get a network to number one on luck.
Steve, we saw this week, just going back to Nine, we saw Two and a Half Men, the return of Two and a Half Men, and then you saw Ashton Kutcher do very well on Nine. Got just shy of 2.3 million. What do you think, ratings like that, Nine haven't been going that well, and then all of a sudden they get a big ratings hit like that. What do you think that does for advertiser confidence? Do you think they'll see an influx of advertisers, or are they still sitting and waiting, do you think?
Alice, you're pointing to the fact that there's too much emotion in these decisions in the marketplace. We're stunned that there's so much forgiveness and emotion. Yes, on an emotional scale, it'll give advertisers a bit of comfort, it'll give buyers something to talk about, positive about Nine, it will assist, as long as the ratings hold up, it'll assist in the run to the negotiations, but it's half our show a week.
Yeah.
Steve, can I just ask what you feel the sentiment's like within top management at Nine and Ten? Do you think there's been at all a sense of panic that they have a lot to do to claw back perhaps the ratings that they've lost over the first half of the year? Or do you think there's a quiet confidence about them?
Wouldn't say there's a quiet confidence, but certainly when they're talking to me, they wouldn't allow any feel of panic to get anywhere near me because we are being so critical. So they're being a bit defensive, I might say. Not at the Gingell level, but at the middle management level, they're trying to make, particularly Nine, they're trying to make everything a winner that they can reach for. So we'd call that a bit of defensiveness. Hamish and Andy, they're marquee programs for the year. And when we go, yeah, but it's halved its launch ratings, they go, so what? And you go, well, it's not going to appear in probably the top 20 this year. Like, this was going to be one of your foundation stones. For goodness sake, either you over-promoted and over-hyped it, or it's not quite doing what it should.
And, you know, I must say, I was puzzled with Hamish and Andy why it fell away as much as it did, because I thought it wasn't a bad show, actually.
Can't agree with you, Tim. Cannot agree with you. I think it's like being in a frat boy's house. And I don't think that makes for great broad-based 1.8 to 2 million television audience. You've really got to be on the money. You've got to be beautifully produced. When you contrast that with Roving Enterprises' Rove LA this week,
which went out on Foxtel,
and you put them side by side, you will see the difference.
I'll tell you what I wonder is, I'm a relatively recent convert to their podcast, so, and they're doing this sister audio podcast to it, and I wonder, because I'm hearing the backstories on the podcast, whether it's influencing me as a TV viewer, because I've already have a sense of what's going on, and whether perhaps that's a part of it.
And I do think it is a part of it, but look, the key thing is that if Roving Enterprises were still producing, directing and managing that talent, the show that went to air would be different. It would be slicker, it would be better scripted, it would be better presented and much better produced. I mean, that opening show, without Taylor Swift, it would have been an absolute bomb. Mm. I mean, she carried that first show. She just somehow got the guys and went, oh, well, yeah, I'll make up a little song on the spot, I'll do whatever. It saved it. But you can't repeat that every week and engage a broader public. Yes, you'll engage a meaningful, smaller public, but it won't be a marquee program if you go that way.
Now, Steve, something I'm always interested by is most journalists, ourselves included, will tend to primarily report all people. For advertisers, that's not always the key demographic to be talking about, though, is it?
Well, practically no briefs. There are some superannuation briefs and financial service products briefs, and there should be a lot more briefs, I might say, but practically no briefs are over the age of 55. Government has many campaigns where it's 18+, but they're a small part of the landscape. You know, even though they're hundreds of millions combined, they're still a small part of the landscape. So that's why we report and keep commenting on 16 to 54, which also doesn't particularly suit David Leckie and the Seven Network, because they always win on all people and by a pretty wide margin, but they don't win by as wide a margin on 16 to 54.
Now let's talk about a few much-loved shows. That's something you've reported on this week, isn't it, Robin?
Yeah, indeed. Wrote a story about some research done by Roy Morgan about Australia's most loved TV show. Interestingly, the Big Bang Theory was voted the most loved show, but obviously it wasn't the Australia's top rating show. Steve, any thoughts on that? Well, first of all, what's your favourite show?
My favourite show? Oh, I've got no idea. What do I dislike missing? Crew and Transfer?
Good choice.
Look, I've got such a long repertoire, but it's part of my job is to look at all these things. I skip through a lot. We've got two IQ machines at home that are always, you know, close to full. So, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at shows or looking at excerpts of shows. I have to think about it. Depends what else we're talking. But, you know, I don't think that way because I'm trying to be dispassionate and at a distance from what
and is,
I it, like.
Is most of your TV diet, though, from network television as opposed to going out and buying big box sets and that sort of thing, for instance?
Yeah, it is. Well, partly because there's no more hours. I can't devote any more hours unless I want to drive my wife and my dog and any visitors to our house crazy. There's just no more hours. So even when I dive over to pay TV and tape some of their top shows or their first eps of their top shows just to get a feel of what they're like and see whether the numbers make sense, even that's hard to squeeze in. It's just you're bombarded by sheer volume of content. And with the number of programming changes that we've had this year, it's been very hard to keep up.
What were the other ones that were there in the most loved list?
Well, the favourite among men was Top Gear. Interestingly, you know, that hasn't rated very well, even though when asked, people say that's their favourite show. And the favourite show among women is Packed to the Rafters, which did rate pretty well. But, yeah, interestingly, there seems to be a disconnect between what rates well and when asked what people actually like watching.
Yes, but in Morgan, I think there's four different scores, and we're only looking at one of the scores. And so it's those that are really committed. We're looking at and commenting on those that are really, truly committed to a show. It's kind of a must-watch. I mean, I will tape it or I will cancel arrangements to be there when it goes to air. I won't take myself out or I'll come home early enough.
And even then, for the you know, Big Bang Theory coming top, only 13.9% of people voted for that. So
yeah,
it's not as if it's, you know, the majority of Australians love it. And I suppose, yeah, you know, Top Gear, fourth overall, 11.6%. You know, that it doesn't actually contradict what it does in the ratings, I suppose. You know, it's just a very committed audience, those who are committed to it, perhaps.
But to go back to Top Gear, you're right. Remember, there's only a dozen eps fresh a year. Or if they get two seasons in the UK, then we've got 24 or a number like that. And, of course, Nine's been playing silly buggers with it. It's another one of those franchises that, in our view, they've ruined by saying one thing in program lines and doing another and shifting it by an hour and shifting it by a day and multiplying it in a week and all this stuff that they do that just annoys the public.
If it got to the point where it just wasn't worth Nine's while to have anymore, and hypothetically BBC Worldwide, you know, when the contract came out, sold it back to SBS or somewhere else, is it a franchise that can be saved, do you think? Or do you think in Australian eyes it's gone now?
No, I think Top Gear could get back, say, to SBS and could get back to the kind of ratings it used to have by being played in a block, by being consistent, by being not shifted around. I mean,
and perhaps having fewer ads to break it up.
Absolutely, that as well. But SBS, you know, when SBS has got a hot property, there it sits. They won't meddle with it. But with Nine, for all sorts of reasons, they do meddle with it.
A couple of other TV issues from this week. 10, getting rid of late news, moving Sandra Sully a bit earlier in the day. Good strategy? Understandable strategy?
Understandable strategy. They're looking at costs and how to max out their costs versus ratings, and that's the job that they're doing, and it was too expensive to produce a 22:30 news or thereabouts each night. There wasn't a real need for it. There was nobody particularly sponsoring it. It was declining in ratings. It wasn't particularly competing well with what was being thrown against it, because there are a lot of niche programs that are now put into main channels at 10:30 or 11:30 at night, first run.
Now, another conversation on Umbrella we had this week was with Chris Stevenson from PhD, who had some interesting predictions to make about the socialisation of TV viewing.
The death of TV has been somewhat overstated. What 2016 explores and talks about is not the death of TV in any way, shape or form, but rather the radical evolution of TV in two directions, really. So in one sense, we're going to see mass socialization of the TV experience. TV will become the fireplace around which we gather, not in a physical space, but in a virtual sense with our social graph. So we'll watch TV and we'll consume TV surrounded by that social graph. And how we interact with that content will be informed by that graph. And so we'll not only see TV viewing with socialized, but we'll also see it in conjunction with other devices. So it'll become second nature to watch TV with a tablet or with a smartphone device that again gives us more access and more data and more information to the content that we're watching.
Now, the book that PhD have come up with is 2016, Beyond the Horizon, which is something they produced globally, but some of it was written here in Australia. What do you see as the changing habits for TV? Do you see it as being this really significant thing where somebody will be sitting watching TV with their iPad open and tweeting and or updating on Facebook or whatever the social network is at the time? Is that going to become a genuinely important part of TV viewing, do you think?
Minor part. Remember when we talk about all these things, we're predominantly talking about very well off, very well-educated, white-collar households that buy all this gadgetry. You know, when you look at tablets versus PCs, they're a very small feature of the market, growing quickly, but still a very, very small feature of the market. And when you look at those who have PCs to the whole of the population, that's still not the majority of the market. So you know, when we look at these issues, we tend to be looking at people like us, and we're at best 20% of the market. That's not what television's all about.
And do you think it will go mainstream, though, or just go in different directions?
It'll creep into it. But you know, for the vast public, smartphones and tablets aren't going to be a feature of their television viewing. They're just not. They may own them, but they're not.
You don't think people start watching TV shows on tablets on their mobiles?
Oh, yes, but it'll be maybe, at best, 20% of the market. At best.
I must admit, I felt like I was joining the future this week when there was going to be a segment on Sunrise which appeared to refer to a story that we'd written about the previous day. The dreadful Wiggles video about how great they were on 9/11. But, you know, I thought, well, I've got to head for work, so rather than walk, I'll jump on the bus and watch the Sunrise app on my iPad. Unfortunately, I couldn't actually make it load, so that was the end of my adventure with mobile television for this year, anyway.
But look, this whole social thing, and I may be, you know, the dinosaur in the room, but this whole social thing, you sit down and you have a cup of coffee or a dinner with somebody, and they want to be on a tablet or an iPhone, I just get up and say, see you sometime.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, not often, and don't bring your technology next time.
There's nothing worse than going for a coffee with someone where they spend the whole
time. It's just rude. It's just not good behaviour. And I think most people will get over that it isn't more important than a one-to-one conversation.
But equally, something like The Joy of Sets, I deliberately didn't watch what people were saying on Twitter during it because I wanted to form my own views. But the minute it ended, I went straight to Twitter to see what people had been saying.
And it is a lot of fun when you're having debate about some fact or something and you can immediately call it up on a tablet or a smartphone and actually look at what the truth is or look at what you're debating.
And did you happen to catch Joy of Sets this week, by the way?
I watched it last night.
What did you think?
I won't give it a thumbs up.
Will you yet give it a thumbs down, though? Or is it just too early to say?
It's too early to say. We haven't done the minute-by-minute splits, is the truth. Mm. I should have done those overnight, but we haven't. Look, it may hold up, but it won't hold up because of the quality of program, in our view. It'll hold up because it's being bookended by yes. 2.5 men.
Yes, it was. It did very well having the first Ashton Kutcher episode next to it. I personally, by the way, I felt there was some promise there. I didn't think it was the finished deal. You could see that it shared a little bit of DNA with The Grand Transfer in terms of taking an aspect of the craft and exploring it, you know, in a different direction. But I think I saw enough to think, well, I'm certainly going to watch the next episode.
Yeah, I reacted kind of the same way, that you know, the jury's out.
Mm. Alice, you saw it, didn't you?
Yes, I wasn't. I'm with Steve there. I wasn't a big fan at all, actually. I was cringing for a lot of it. My favourite part was when they brought in Country Practice, Esme Watson. That was my highlight. but I'll let, you know, I'll watch it next week and hopefully they find their feet.
One more TV story. Kind of curious one, this one. 7 and 10 were found to be in breach of the Commercial TV Code of Practice over how they covered a confrontation between a 9 cameraman and the father of somebody who had just been in court. The actual case happened a while back, but the report from ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, has just come out. Robin, what did you make of this?
Well, I watched the clip on Media Watch and must say I was horrified. Once it played out, it transpired that, you know, to get a rise out of these two Muslim gentlemen, that the cameraman called him a terrorist. I think perhaps out of frustration, but yeah, basically to get a story. I thought that was fairly horrific. But yeah, and all the ruling I found strange, that the fact that 9 weren't involved, even though it was 7 and 10 that got their wrist slapped.
Well, this ruling, I suppose, was about accuracy and how they reported it. And 9 didn't air any of that confrontation. So, you know, very poor behaviour, and it's worth recognising that 9 suspended and then the cameraman left. So, you know, arguably they reacted to it. But, you know, they weren't one of the ones that the complaint was about in terms of ACMA.
Yeah, it seemed to be the story was about what the channels chose to leave out as much as what they actually reported. Mm. But also someone mentioned in the comment stream that the 9 cameraman, Simon Fuller, actually apologised to these gentlemen afterwards, and that wasn't recorded either.
Yeah. No, I hadn't seen that last part that you just mentioned. I mean, I just thought the whole situation was appalling, overzealous reporting and pursuit, but hey, you know, you kind of, when you hear all the different feeds of what really occurred, you kind of go, oh, OK.
Well, next, Telstra's Technicolor rebrand.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Telstra unveiled a brand revamp this week. It sees its blue and orange logo replaced with a multicoloured badge. It's one of the biggest brand initiatives in the company's history and comes 8 months after the appointment of Mark Buckman as Chief Marketing Officer. Interbrand did the brand work and DDB did the advertising. Let's have a listen to the ads.
Things are happening at one of Australia's biggest brands. We're improving many of the ways we work so we can connect you to all the things you need and all the things you love better than ever before. We're changing the way we look and sound too. We now live in full colour because we know you do. It helps make us more relevant to you and your life. Whether you're an outback miner or an inner-city teen, a merchant banker or a local florist, someone who needs to connect with faraway places, or someone who needs to keep a piece of home with them when they're on the go. The way we now look is all about representing the way we connect with you, the way you connect with our products, and of course, how you connect to the people in your life. We sound different to how we used to as well. It's all about taking complicated subjects and talking about them in uncomplicated ways. And concentrating on speaking like human beings, not like machines. And we're doing all of this to help us show all Australians just how amazing connected life can be. Because although it means something different to everyone, connection is important to every single one of us. After all, we can't be human on our own.
So, Steve, have you seen the rebrand? What did you think of the work?
Could anyone have missed it?
Yeah, you know? No, indeed. And do you think it did it make you like Telstra?
It didn't have a wow factor, but I get it. What I get is it's refraction. What they're playing on is refraction of light. That's what they're going to, and I think that's clever in this digital age and the new technology that they're employing. I think that's clever. I can see where that all connects. But maybe I'm overthinking it. You know, I think it's enormously difficult for such a big corporation, particularly one that's so connected with the public, to put on a new suit of clothes and to have a wow factor with it. I think it'll be an interesting conversation if we visit this once a year, this time every year, and see how it's unfolded. That will be the key, actually, for Telstra.
Yes, I mean, I've been in Australia since March. My experience with the Telstra brand isn't bad at all. It's fairly neutral. I'm not a Telstra customer, so I don't have the experience of history. Tim, what do you make of the? I remember you've written an opinion piece about this, where you think that this rebrand plus your experience with Telstra means that you don't hate them as much as you used to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is one of those brands that, because it's so big as a company, most consumers have had some direct experience of the service.
And it was a monopoly.
And then
it was a duopoly.
And of course, what that means is that, they tend to come from the perspective of, it's not just about what the branding says, it's about the experience.
Yeah.
So for me, I haven't been in the country about 5 years, right during the reign of Sol Trujillo, where, you know, the customer experience really didn't seem to matter very much.
No.
You know, every experience would be poor, and it almost didn't matter what the branding was. You know, you would try it again and it would be poor. And I think what has been going on is Telstra is genuinely investing a lot of effort and a lot of time into improving the customer experience. Not there yet, absolutely not there yet, but have moved, I think. Just things like going 24/7 in a lot of the phone services. Or, you know, whereas before you're in this race against the clock to get through before 6 p.m. And if you did, then, you know, one of the experiences, I mean, I was someone berating me because I was going to make him late to leave, you know, and I'd been on hold for 40 minutes at that point, you know, all of those little things. And there was just, everyone had some sort of Telstra horror story.
Yeah.
But so I think, you know, absolutely what they've got now with this rebrand is a fighting chance because the experience has improved. So yeah, it feels like the right thing to do at the right time.
Yeah, it has improved, but do you think this rebrand has come a little bit too early? Do you think Telstra needs to have done more to improve its customer service and more to improve its product before launching this rebrand? And obviously, if it was to do this a year ago, when no changes had been made, that would have been a mistake. What do you think about the timing, Steve?
I think that the management group is looked at their horizon and looked at what's going to unfold, and they've got a bit of confidence about an improving customer interface and improving customer service. Quadient, they've seen one competitor a bit shaky and going to go from two brands to one brand, and they're taking the opportunity saying, well, we're not going to drop the ball anymore and we're actually going to improve, so let's do it now and get ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they've done. They've gone ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Do you think there's a sense? I mean, Mark Buckman, it's these things about a new marketing director, new CMO, comes in, wants to make changes. Do you think perhaps he was little impatient and wanted to get things done quickly and has rebranded too early? I mean, he's been there, you know, only this year.
In fairness, a lot of this work was done before he got there.
Right.
We also saw not that long ago Mark Collis brought in from a creative ECD, executive creative director background, brought in to drive the creativity. So I think he was one of the, you know, there were a couple of other key players. I mean, you obviously went to the briefing with them, so you'll be aware of that. But, you know, this is something that Buckman kind of inherited. And I suppose, also arguably, there is no perfect time with something like this, is it? Sometimes you've just got to jump.
Yes, yeah, no, indeed. I went along to the briefing and met Mark Collis, and Marty O'Hallahan, who's runs advertising for DDB, their advertising agency. Yeah, and it seems that they've got a massive job on their hands. It's the biggest marketing department in Australia, 550 people. Interestingly, on the lift on the way down, I bumped into a chap, a Telstra employee. He said, so who are you? I said, yeah, I'm a journalist. Just been to interview the marketing team. He said, yeah, it's great what they're doing. I feel invigorated. I feel proud to work for Telstra. And it did feel like, has this guy been planted?
We all forget that there's many publics involved here. There are many stakeholders, and the employees, the sheer volume of employees they've got, they're probably number one or number two on their list when they make these changes. They might not admit that, but in other major corporates that we work for or have done work for, you know, their own employees are sometimes number one. So you spend all these millions of dollars out front on television or in newspapers, but in fact the people that you want to take most notice and feel most good are your employees.
Yes. Yeah, no, indeed. I made a point of, after the interview, going down into the Telstra Customer Experience Centre. And it was impressive. Sort of shiny walls, gleaming sort of TV monitors and pristine-looking staff.
I always feel sorry for them in there, though, because you go in there and it's completely empty, and then you step out and look across the road at the Apple store, which is absolutely packed.
Yeah, but again, the experience centre was populated by a lot of grumpy customers.
There are actually customers in there.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't when I went in, so.
You know, we have people in our business that can take any amount of brickbats, and they just, yes, we'll do that. Oh, we'll hand it. Oh, I'm sorry, we've missed that. You know, that you've just got to have a personality that can deal with that all day long and not take to the gin bottle when you go home at night.
Next, Aussie agencies get a shake-up.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. Now, we're currently seeing a shake-up in Australia's ad agency landscape, particularly those owned by Interpublic. Robin, you've been on top of this one. What's going on?
OK. Well, first of all, I should note that the agencies involved haven't confirmed the news yet, but we think that two of Interpublic's struggling agencies, one is McCann, the other is Lowe, have been trying to effectively buy their way out of trouble and obscurity by acquiring local independence. Lowe has bought 303, which is an independent agency of 110 to 120 people.
And we should probably say that 303 continue to deny it, despite the fact that we're reasonably confident of the fact.
Yes, they do. Again, 303 offices in Perth and Sydney, been doing pretty well. McCann has bought Smart, an agency of 80 people. So we're seeing these two Interpublic shops trying to bulk up, we think, by making these purchases.
And again, we should probably say that McCann haven't officially made their announcement, but again, we're confident of our facts.
Yes, no, indeed. And just on the management side, the changes will be effectively two reverse takeovers. We think that the boss of McCann, Chris Mort, will be replaced by Smart's boss, Ben Lilly. And we think that Lowe's boss, Stephen Pearson, will be replaced by 303 boss, Nick Cleaver. A lot of change.
Yeah, very much so. Steve, I mean, you're... I was thinking about this as we were coming in. I would imagine that in terms of media and marketing journalists, you've outlasted everybody in the market, I suspect. So you've probably seen more agencies come and go than anyone else who's actually commentating on the media and the advertising side of the world. What do you make of the sort of strategy of kind of, you know, if you're a big network, buying your way in? Is that just the pragmatic thing to do?
Absolutely. It's the easiest way to fix a problem. It doesn't mean that you'll fix the problem, but if you buy a profitable, cutting-edge, great reputation agency that's got very good people and very good systems and very good culture, and you're struggling with your own, it can be the panacea for moving forward. Of course, it can be ruinous because... But it's good to hear that probably the incumbent agencies are actually going to be reversed takeovers, so the new culture comes in and overwhelms what was there and hopefully fixes that up. I mean, I'm surprised that McCann's feel that they're struggling. It wouldn't have been my perception that they were struggling or losers. It would have been my perception that they're not moving forward as well as they should. Lowe, on the other hand, they've had a really rough 5 years. quite a rough.
Yeah, we hear that low could be down to as little as as few as 15 people. Yeah. That's including freelancers. It really has dwindled. McCann, yeah, agreed, not so bad. Yeah. About 60 people there. But still, for it's, I think McCann's the largest advertising network in the world, give or take, perhaps up there with Y&R. So to see an agency of its stature globally be such a small force in Australia, yeah, is something needs to change.
Especially when their media agencies are actually doing quite well. You know, they're having a nice time. So, you know, they've gone, the media agencies, which of course I'm very proud of, the media agencies have gone out of the shadows of the creative agency and the communications conglomerate and started to shine and make their own way in the world. And the agencies that used to control them are somewhat struggling.
Yeah, and Tim, there's a new boss at Naked Communications. Tell us a bit about what's happening there.
Yeah, so more agency change there as well. And I've got to say, firstly, the press release is an absolute thing of beauty when it comes to diplomacy. So the history of Naked... Well, the history of Naked is it was founded in London by three guys, one of whom was kind of the aggressive, kick down the door, you know, beat everyone up, make things happen. One of them was kind of the super smooth client guy, and one of them was the mad professor. And they absolutely mirrored it when they launched in Australia. So here in Australia, the three kind of founding partners who launched it were Matt Baxter was the guy to kick the doors down, Mike Wilson the guy to be super smooth with the clients, and then Adam Ferrier to be the mad professor. And we've seen some changes for Naked Australia already. Matt Baxter left a couple of years ago, popped up at MediaCom, and now is at UM and is CEO at UM. So changes had already sort of happened. But what we've now seen is... Well, firstly, we saw, I guess, in a similar space, Bellamy Hayden closed their doors. They're both Photon agencies. They were merged
in.
That's the key. And that's the key, yes. And that brought Phil Hayden in, who well-respected in the market. So Phil Hayden has now come in running the whole APAC area, of which I guess Australia is still the powerhouse, particularly out of Sydney. You know, they're still quite new into Singapore, still quite new out. I think Mumbai is the other one there.
Tokyo.
Quite new into. Tokyo's been there a bit longer, I think. But obviously, he's the boss now. That's certainly the impression I get. That's where the reporting lines are. So the other two managing partners, I noticed that Adam's title, it said Adam will remain as founding partner. So the title has changed from managing partner to founding partner. And he's also been given the head of global head of behavioural science, or global head of BS, as he put it, which was self-deprecating and amusing. And Mike Wilson becomes chairman. Again, it doesn't look like there are direct reporting lines to him, but, you know, that gives him, I guess, you know, weight and credibility within the organisation. So it's all been very diplomatically done. And I'm not saying these guys have got particularly large egos, because within this industry, I don't think they have particularly. But I think everyone's egos have been managed quite well. But, you know, there's a new leader at the top. So it feels to me like they've done that quite well.
Yeah. And would you say that Naked in this market stand pretty much alone in the comms planning space? I remember when they launched in London, they're excellent at PR. A brilliant stunt agency. Obviously, they do some execution now, but it used to be very much their own comms planning only. Tongue is another agency in that space. Do you see them as the sole serious challenger to Naked in that space, or are Naked gunning solely for media agencies?
I mean, Tongue, and I'm sure Steve's going to have a view on this, Tongue shares some DNA in that Jonathan Pearce and John DuVernay both came out of Naked anyway, so there is a little bit of shared DNA there. But I guess this is an area which you at least cross over with, Steve, really, you know, on the, you know, the pure strategy side of things.
Yeah, we do. I don't think that they're massaging or managing egos. I think they're trying to manage a cultural and business model change. That's what my perception would be from what they've done. I think they're trying to take large steps. When you read the Sands in Photon, one gets the sense that they might not be terribly profitable, and they might not be, business-wise, from Photon's point of view, quite going in the right direction. And one senses that this is why these changes are being made, that they're trying to get somebody or a new culture that's more focused on results for Naked or something like that, and maybe a bit more structure and not quite as wacky and off the wall and not quite as much stunting has been, because, you know, Matt Baxter kind of left there because of stunting.
Yes, the whole... We won't go into the whole...
Let's not go there, because he's very talented. Let's not go there. But, you know, stunting is a big thing that they used to do, and it was very good for their clients, and it was a good technique. But, you know, if you're going to be a big business, it's got to be a lot more than that.
Can you be a big business on pure strategy?
I think you can. I think you do have to have extra capability as Robin was saying, you've got to be able to execute and be able to execute fabulously well. So you've got to decide whether you're going to have kind of planners there as well, and how far down that line you're going to go before you let it wander off to a master agency media buyer or up buyer of some sort. We have the same problem. I mean, you know, you get very precious about your strategies and you want them implemented with perfection, and you don't want anyone messing with it, and you become a bit too obsessive about it.
Next, what's in a name?
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
So the debate has continued into the issue of online anonymity this week. Mumvella's audience seems to be divided on whether anonymous postings on websites should be allowed. Blogger Craig Tomler has argued that online anonymity is needed in our industry. He says, and I quote, "Anonymity has a long and illustrious history in the media and politics as a tool to allow passionate discussion without public retribution. I feel anonymity is a requirement for democracy, a necessary component of a free media. Sure, it's not always pretty, but we'll just have to toughen up and live with it." So, Steve, any thoughts on this? Do you think it's necessary for commenters to identify themselves?
I'm the wrong person to ask, Robin. We never talk ever off the record.
Or perhaps you're the right person to ask.
We just never talk off the record, because when we started what we do now, which is just insane, and you kind of want to get off the bike, but anyway, what we do now comes from the fact that when we started doing this, we did it for a marketing reason. But what we noticed in the marketplace then, that everyone was deep throat, no one was on the page, no one was declaring their position, everyone was rumour mongering. It was just vile in our view. It was just wasn't well informed. It allowed journalists to misreport things. You know, when you're never off the record and you're saying things and you remember well what you've said, I've never been misquoted, or we've never claimed that we've been misquoted. Sometimes we've regretted things that we've said, but. You know, we totally and absolutely believe in standing up for what you believe in and saying it, and being good enough to have thought about it long enough or done the background in statistics and what have you to come to a point of view. You know, you'll get pillared. We do. You absolutely get pillared, and sometimes you'll get things wrong, but we think that's a much better course of action, and that's what we would encourage the industry to go towards. But I do get where he's coming from. It's just that... That the people that perform to his standard are the minority of anonymous bloggers and anonymous contributors. You know, the vast majority of that content is vile, not well-founded, not backed up with any facts, and if you stood them up against a wall and said, justify yourself with a television camera running, they would look piss poor.
I think perhaps that's an opinion that would be shared by Anthony Freeman, who's chairman of the Communications Council and CEO of Host, who wrote an article on SMH quite recently about calling anonymous posters cowardly. Now, Tim, what are your thoughts on perhaps Craig Tomler's piece and also the views of Anthony Freeman?
Yeah, it is one I'm going to sit slightly on the fence on. It's worth, for those who aren't aware, we do allow anonymous comments. We pre-moderate now, which means that there's a fair bit doesn't go up, and obviously only we can know how nasty some of the things people post are. at the same time, we still get criticised, and it's an absolutely legitimate point of view, for some of the stuff that we do allow to go up. So some of that is a moderation decision rather than an anonymity decision. So I wonder whether some of the debate needs to be about whether, you know, whether on Mumbrella or, you know, any other site, the failing is in the moderation rather than in the anonymity. So that I think is one part of the debate. Interestingly, by the time this podcast goes up, we'll have also put up a video interview with Professor Julian Disney, who runs the Press Council. He makes that same point. He would actually like to see newspapers that have online sites and allow comments to take far more responsibility for the comments that follow. And again, they moderate, but it's, you know, what is allowed and isn't allowed from effectively anonymous people. So I wonder whether some of this conversation is going to shift from sheer anonymity to one of moderation. And that's, you know, that's difficult. You know, For instance, my sort of instinct is certainly if someone's being personally abusive about someone, then of course don't allow it. But if someone anonymously says an ad's terrible, then sometimes it really is a terrible ad. Mm. You know, simple as that. And they may not feel able, say they, you know, even if they work at a rival agency or they work at a media agency that's in the same group or something, they may well not feel able to say that they think it's a terrible ad, you know. Their job, they may not be senior enough that their job will allow them to do so.
Mm. And it's worth noting we've got about 500 unpublished comments in our back end right now. I mean, some of those are, yeah, I guess unpublishable.
Yeah, and some are just libelous, so obviously we wouldn't be able to anyway. But many of them are just on taste.
Yes, yeah. Steve, anything else on have you commented anonymously or
never?
Right,
never will.
So you'd always put your name next to a comment that you make on a
absolutely story. never will go in that space. Just don't believe in it at all. Grow balls.
And on that note, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our guest Steve Allen.
Thanks so much, Tim.
And to Alice.
Thanks.
And to Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
The Mumbrella Cast is sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. It was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pip.